You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's hard to believe today when the average email inbox is filled with foreign inheritance scams, cheap pharmaceutical ploys, and personal information phishing attempts that early proponents of the internet believed that it would be an international free zone of expression, free of regulation, and that people who tried to use this media in bad faith would be neutralized by technology and the moral will of the online community. Well, ask any policeman. He'll tell you where there's money, there's crime. And as our online tools grew, criminal enterprise followed. Online interest communities became a haven for child porn. As email became ubiquitous, a pair of immigration lawyers in 1994 started sending out unsolicited emails. All of a sudden, spam is everywhere. Illegal file sharing, drugs and weapon sales, and much more followed. Well, my guest today has chronicled how law enforcement first reacted and continued to try to regulate the net. His book, The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed, examines how law enforcement struggled to adapt to this new technology, but eventually developed powerful new tools that, while effective against crime, threatened the civil liberties of law-abiding citizens as well. Nate Anderson is the author of The Internet Police. He's a deputy editor at the online magazine Ars Technica. His work has been published in The Economist and Foreign Policy, and he joins us today by phone. Nate Anderson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Your new book, The Internet Police, you begin with how people thought internet technology was going to change how we define what's regulated, what's not. And you begin with a story of a little startup internet server farm called Haven Co., which took one of the, it sounds very much akin to where they actually developed, which was off the coast of the United Kingdom in an offshore fort that had been abandoned that had been once used by pirate radio. And they sort of set up the same thing for internet users.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the craziest stories that came out of the whole dot-com explosion of the late 1990s and 2000s. And the idea was that this rusting fort in the North Sea, a few miles off the English coast, would become a data center. They would put all these computer servers in there, and they would host any sort of content with almost no exception. There were one or two exceptions. I believe child pornography and terrorism were about the only things they wouldn't host. But anything else, they said, go for it, and we will make your data available to the world so you can reach all these countries who don't want what you're offering. So what they ended up doing was hosting a lot of online gambling in particular, which was then able to reach the very lucrative U.S. market where such activities weren't allowed. So it was a really interesting attempt to do what they looked at as creating a space for freedom, for really changing the nature of national regulation by just moving beyond state borders. And thanks to the internet, you could then send your information back across those borders, and there wasn't going to be anything that governments could do about it. And the real shift I trace in the book was just how effectively governments did learn to do something about it. I mean, they were not going to let this go without a fight because it would have represented really the end of most, you know, national laws that governed any sort of information from child pornography to speech to gambling.
And in the case of Haven Co., it's a hilarious story in many senses because they actually joined forces with a guy who had basically claimed one of these offshore forts and set up his own country, even though it was still under the jurisdiction of the UK.
Well, right. So that the whole reason they went to this fort in the middle of the ocean was because when this English family seized this abandoned fort back in the 60s, they began using it for pirate radio. But they later realized that it was outside of UK territorial waters. And therefore, they claimed that it was their own country. And even though the UK later extended its territorial waters, they were sort of grandfathered in. And so they continue to claim that they are a country known as Sealand and that they have their own laws and that that is what allows this whole crazy experiment to take place under the cover of law, was the fact that this was said to be its own country.
But even this family, the Bates family that owned this as the quote-unquote rulers of Sealand, pretty soon started putting limits on Haven Co. So we see that even this, you know, sort of a loon ruler will put limits on this very powerful communication form.
Yeah, I mean, what you see in this story is the importance of law. And even Haven Co., which wanted to evade most national laws, suddenly found out that without the power of law and courts to back it up and to enforce things like contracts, it really came down to sort of law of the jungle. Who's got the power? And the family that controlled the platform and had the security guys on it was the ones with the power. So when push came to shove, there wasn't a whole lot that the guys running Haven Co. could do, and the whole venture sort of collapsed in acrimony, and it didn't make, you know, the money that they all hoped to make, and the whole thing really just fell apart.
Well, as you began delving into these stories, which I assume at Ars Technica this is something you guys do, what was the purpose of the Internet Police? What was the story, overall story, you wanted to tell?
So I wanted to see what happened to that world of the late 1990s and 2000s, the world where so many people believed that a massive reconfiguration was coming, where you could move beyond these national laws and restrictions easily just by putting your servers and your computers in other countries where they didn't care what you did or where your behavior was legal, and then you could reach the world. And if you go back and look at some of the rhetoric of the time, including from some prominent federal judges, there was a widespread sense that we just can't do anything about this. There wasn't a good way to police behavior on the Internet. And yet, in a lot of my more recent reporting, I had seen all sorts of, well, really crazy stories about how effective and sometimes creepy Internet policing had become, and how it had pervaded all levels of policing, from local cops around where I live, who regularly make busts in our communities for child pornography possession, all the way to the FBI, to Interpol, and everyone in between had gotten involved in this stuff. So the rhetoric from the 90s didn't seem to have played out the way that its backers thought, and I wanted to take a look at how that had happened and what things look like today.
And what you find on all of these stories is that laws are pretty ill-equipped to handle this changing technology. In fact, laws are struggling to keep up. The limits, whether you've set limits because of freedom issues and privacy issues, or, you know, what polices can and can't do, has always lagged behind what's happening.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that was interesting, though, was that the lag you talked about certainly took place. And so it took maybe 5, 6, 7 years for groups like the FBI to really get up to speed on this. But, you know, they didn't just sit still and say, hey, Internet crime, it occurs between countries, it's really complicated, it's hard to track down, we're going to ignore it. What they did was they refocused, they got more money, they began setting up special cybercrime units that they now have in every FBI field office. And one of the big things this forced the police to do was really just cooperate, because so many investigations involving the Internet became international investigations. That used to be a huge problem. It just took forever to get police in another country to help you out. And that's not really the case anymore. Cops have really gotten better at sharing information when they need to. And so, you know, what you see is, well, the Internet created this whole new world. Police responded to it, and the bad guys have responded to them, and then the police have responded again. So it's been a real back and forth. It's hard to say who has the upper hand at the moment. But for most people, unless you're a serious hacker or a real cyber criminal, you know, the Internet is a place where you probably can get caught if the police really want to at this point.
Yeah. One of the first stories you tell is how the police geared up to one of the one areas that everybody agreed on that the Internet shouldn't protect, that it shouldn't have freedom against, and that was child pornography. And once the Internet became ubiquitous, that seemed to be a safe haven for those folks for a few years. You tell the story of how the FBI and various law enforcement agencies broke a particularly nasty group of child pornographers called the Cache. Explain the Cache, if you would.
It was really just a message board where people, you know, with interest in child pornography would gather. They had to be vetted to enter this community. To enter the board, they had to have a username and password. They had to be recommended by someone who was already there. And once inside, they would exchange links to this material that they stored around the Internet, share it with each other. They took precautions to avoid getting caught, but they weren't particularly great precautions. And this community became one of the largest that U.S. law enforcement had ever discovered to date. This was in 2008 and 2009 when they really broke this up. And at that point, it was the largest community. It was 1,500 people at its height, all of whom were pretty serious about sharing these kinds of images. And some of them, you know, it turned out later, appeared to be contact offenders, which means they were involved in actually abusing children themselves. So it was a pretty massive bust. It took several years and, you know, required that international cooperation that I was talking about. I mean, this case began in Australia, where local cops just found one video on a guy's computer in which someone was speaking with a Flemish accent. So they involved the Belgian police then, who looked at this video, analyzed it, actually found the guy in the video, who was a father who was abusing his own children. Then they found out where the father had gone to do this, and it was a studio in the Ukraine set up to film this kind of material. And then they found the person who ran that studio, who was an Italian. And so they got the Italian police to arrest him when he came back to Italy. And then they found his email list of everyone who had been interested in his product. And then they shared that list with the Europeans and then with the FBI here in the U.S., who investigated all the U.S. addresses on the list. So it was really a textbook case of how the Internet police do their work today, how we get international cooperation, and what these cases look like. Child pornography would not have looked like this 20 years ago just because of how hard it was to meet people with those interests, how hard international communication was. But today it's a really international venture and requires international responses.
And of course, this has been like an onion unpeeling too. I think that was called Operation Joint Hammer. But what's happened is as they just keep unpeeling the onions, they find more trails.
Right. So one of the things that you learn is that some of the old techniques used to break up old social networks. For instance, the mafia, which really relied on social connections, work with child pornography as well, and they apply to the Internet just like they did to the real world. So cops today, one of their standard techniques with these things is you infiltrate a network like the Cache, you break it up, but you also, when you arrest the people, you immediately try to find out what other networks were they involved in, because people were often involved in more than one. And what happens during the arrest process is that you usually turn up new leads, new communities of these guys that you didn't even know existed before. And so you immediately launch a new investigation into those. And yeah, so this investigation has already spawned two or three others, all stemming from this tip going back to this one computer in Australia. And it's been playing out now for 5 years. It's still not done. One or two of these further investigations have come to light and have also resulted in massive busts. But the process is ongoing, yeah.
The next story you tell in your book, The Internet Police, you know, most people, they think of computer communication as not really being completely safe and completely private. But somehow we sort of put that out of mind. We tend to think it is private. And this next story just blows it out of the water. And it involves what are called RATs or remote access tools. You show it in the hands of an individual, corporations, as well as government. This shows us how literally unsafe and unprivate anything that happens on electronic communication can be. You start with the story of Luis Miangos. Who is Luis Miangos?
So this guy Miangos was a disabled hacker in California. He had attended some community college there, had a job, was making some money, but apparently felt some kind of rage against the world and decided to take that out on people by downloading this remote access tool software and attempting to slip it into the computers of hundreds of young women, many of them in California, but in other states as well. He would then, I should say a word about what this kind of software can do, because it's really incredible. It's called a remote administration tool because it really does make you a remote administrator with full privileges over someone's computer. You can watch through their webcam what is happening in front of them. You can watch what they're doing on their screen. You can browse through their files, look at every document they have stored on their computer. You can watch them as they instant message with their friends. You can actually listen through the microphone of their laptop to conversations they were having in their room, you know, in the real world. And this guy would do that. He would do things like, he went well beyond just looking for sexually explicit images, which is what he began with. And then he would torment these women. So there was one college student in California where he would actually do things like turn on her microphone of her laptop, listen to her while she was in her room talking about him to campus police or to other people, and then he would get in touch with her and say that he knew she was doing that and that she needed to stop. And this just terrified her to no end because it was about the biggest invasion of privacy you could imagine. And he was doing this to hundreds of people.
Wow. Now, how did police catch up with him?
Well, one of the lessons you learn from these kinds of stories is that today you don't have to be a really awesome hacker who knows how to write computer code to really do most of these things. For instance, remote administration tools can be downloaded free of charge or for a nominal fee from many sites around the internet. It requires very little experience to deploy them. And so he was one of these guys who had modest skills but was not really an elite computer user. And how they got him is a bit of a technical explanation, but it wasn't all that difficult. And, you know, it just shows that unless you really know what you're doing, the cops can generally get you if you bring yourself to their attention. And this guy certainly did by going after hundreds of people and not even just rifling through the contents of their computer, but then actually harassing them to the point where the FBI, you know, as part of this case and a few others, has coined a new term it uses called sextortion, which is what this guy was engaged in. He would threaten to release pictures of them in sexually explicit photos to their friends, put them on Facebook, release them to the world unless these people did things he wanted for him.
Now, the next story on this same subject was a substitute teacher named Susan Clement Jeffrey, who was greeted at the door by the police. This is not a case of an individual using one of these tools, but a corporation.
Yeah, and, you know, I wanted to start the book by focusing on the child pornography investigation, because I think, as you said, everyone agrees that that's kind of a red line. That is not going to be acceptable behavior. And, you know, really most techniques used to bring those down are inoffensive to people. But things get more complicated when you mix it up a little bit and you start to see what some of these tools and techniques, although they can be used to investigate these kinds of crimes, and the FBI, in fact, uses these tools, can also be deeply creepy, and we have got to be very careful about how they're used. In this case, the police showed up to a substitute teacher's door in Ohio with printouts of this woman's instant messaging chats with her boyfriend, and these printouts included pictures of her topless as she was chatting in her apartment privately with her boyfriend. They were not taken through her window or anything. They were taken from her computer communication somehow. And it turns out that the laptop she had purchased from a student had been stolen from the local school district. And the local school district, in order to find stolen laptops, had some corporate tracking software installed on them. It was essentially a remote administration tool. It allowed the company to turn on the webcam, to take pictures of what was happening on the screen, in order to help recover these machines.
And they then turned over the information to the police. And basically, they were monitoring her computer until she did something that gave her away, basically.
That's right. The company just began watching her chats and things until, you know, over time, you eventually do things like type your name at some point. Or they could look at her passwords, which might include her name or the name of her children. And eventually, you can build up a profile of, where is this person? They might mention places they go to or the state they live in or, you know, anything else that can kind of pin them down. And so eventually they realized what city this laptop was in. They thought they had the woman's name. They included these pictures of her so police could identify her. And the company then proactively got in touch with the local police. They reached a local cop who did theft investigations for the city, and they sent him all this information. And he decided it'd be a good idea to print all of this stuff out and just take it with him to the woman's front door. And, you know, in depositions later, because, of course, she sued the police department over this, he claimed he had no idea, you know, that this would be bothersome behavior to have an officer of the law showing up at somebody's house with their chat logs and with topless photos of them taken out of their own computer. He had no intention of doing anything like that, he said. So. And that may well have been true. It just seemed like a great investigative lead that he had.
And in fact, they were going to charge her with a crime of receiving stolen property, although they had tracked other machines, and they'd gone after the person who actually stole the machines, But in her case, because she bought it from a student, it was different than, say, a person who bought it on eBay.
Right. They decided they were going to arrest the teacher. Yeah, and the charge was receiving stolen property. It was a very strange case, and, you know, it was dismissed as soon as it got to the local district attorney, who declined to prosecute it. And the substitute teacher eventually sued the police department, and it was settled out of court for an undisclosed, you know, we don't know what the settlement was, but it was dealt with privately.
My guest today is Nate Anderson, the deputy editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. And you tell the story of Carnivore, which was the first, what do they call it, data sniffers, which I would assume that's ubiquitous now today, given our national security situation. Tell the story of that. But you also tell us the story of the little pill that you'll watch it late at night and you see the guy smiling, Bob, Insight, which is supposedly an herbal formula that helps your libido. But the story of Insight is something that actually helped all of us. It gave us a little more email privacy, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, this was one of these ad campaigns for this Insight that just blanketed late night TV. I used to see these ads all the time. With Smilin' Bob. But it turns out the company behind Insight was, as a federal judge put it, almost a purely fraudulent entity that engaged in all manner of bad behavior. I mean, they would just relabel drugs without changing the formulation of the drug, and it would say, well, now this drug has a new name, and, you know, it's good for this. But it was the same thing. And they would do all sorts of things. You know, one of the big ways they made all this money, I mean, they became insanely profitable, was they put everybody who called up on this auto ship program where they would get a new supply every month, whether they wanted to do that or not. And then they made it hard to cancel. And there was a long list of this kind of behavior.
I have to stop you for a second, because one of the things they did was they actually removed their return address off the labels.
Oh, I mean, they did everything. They would say that the product is guaranteed, but then when people called in to complain that it hadn't worked or they didn't want it or whatever, they would at one point require them to go to a doctor and obtain a certified doctor's note that the product didn't work for them. And as a federal appellate judge noted, very few people were going to get a note from their doctor saying that they had a small penis. And this is what they relied on, you know, to keep people from complaining and to keep the money coming in. So as you can imagine, this led to massive complaints, big enough that the FBI eventually staged a pretty major investigation of the company behind Insight. And as part of that investigation, one of the things they did was get access to the founder's emails, which were stored on his computer. But what they did was, instead of going in with a search warrant and getting them off his computer, because it turned out he deleted his emails very quickly, you know, you don't want to leave a record of this kind of stuff, they went to the server operator, the people who provided his email service to him. They went in with an order asking these guys to retain in a separate account every email that came in to this guy's account and then turn it over to the FBI. This became really controversial. Can you do this without a full-on wiretap order? And it turns out you can't. The FBI had really overreached with what they were trying to do. And so even though the emails were really incriminating information, you know, courts, this became a big decision that went through the trial court and then went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers much of the Midwest. And the appellate court agreed this was over the top. There's a high standard for that sort of email scrutiny, and the FBI had not met it. And so they have set a precedent now that's been in place for 4 or 5 years, requiring wiretap orders or search warrants for accessing much of that email. So it's one of the seminal cases that has helped put more protections in place, because what you'll find if you pay attention to many of these cases is that grabbing your email or doing these sorts of things is now a routine investigative tool from the FBI and even local cops. I mean, they all know the first thing you do when you get a subject now, a suspect, is you go to Google, you go to Yahoo, you go to Facebook, you go to Apple, and you try and get all their instant messages, their emails, etc. And so this was one of the few cases that put some strong limits on it.
The next story you tell is of one particular downloader, music downloader, who claimed she wasn't, in a music file sharing case. And we don't hear too much about music file sharing cases, although I think if you work for a large company, you'll know that a lot of those limits are still in place, especially like a university, like where this radio station is. Universities are really frightened of lawsuits against illegal file downloading. And you tell a story of a music file sharing case that I guess it was finally resolved just this last spring. And it was the story of Jamie Thomas Rassett, who basically got a notice that she, I assume it was some sort of cease and desist order and a bill for illegal download, says, I'm not paying it. They sued her. And this case went on for years, even after the industry basically quit filing most of these cases.
Yeah. This was a case brought by the recording industry, which represents the major music recording labels in the U.S. And for a time in the mid-2000s, they were suing thousands of people. I mean, I think at the end, they had 18,000 people or more who they had gone after. And what would happen is they would ask you for, they'd say, hey, we've detected the address of your computer sharing files over the internet. You've been sharing our songs without paying, you know, pay up a settlement fee, or we're going to sue you. Many people settled. Jamie Thomas Rassett was one of the few who did not. She was a single mom in Minnesota. She claimed she didn't do it, although a federal judge later concluded that she was lying about that. But whatever happened with the file sharing, her case just shows, you know, the internet makes some of these things so easy, and yet our laws really haven't kept pace. And so the only way legally to deal with this issue was to file a major federal lawsuit against this woman over what really came down to 24 songs that she could have gotten for 99 cents a piece through a service like iTunes. But, you know, copyright is a federal issue, and this became this massive case. It dragged on for over 5 years. She had three separate trials. It just showed that, like, companies that want to enforce those kinds of rights on the internet, it simply doesn't scale. You cannot go after individuals this way, you know, in any sort of economically reasonable method. I mean, the industry spent millions of dollars on this single case, and they have yet to see a dime from this woman. The case went all the way. It reached an appeal to the Supreme Court earlier this year, as you mentioned, which denied it. The woman was then held to be guilty. She owes several hundred thousand dollars to the music industry. She claims she cannot and will not pay it. And that's where we're at now after years of effort, you know, on this particular issue.
I found something interesting that you put towards the end of the chapter on that was how juries have no idea how to even to enforce a damage claim, because in 2007, she was fined $9,200 a song. 2 years later, in two different settings, it was $80,000 a song, that was reduced down to $22,500 per song. And then in 2010, it was $62,000 a song.
Yeah, and throughout, the judge overseeing the case repeatedly stepped in to throw out these numbers and say that anything over $2,200 a song was basically unconscionable. So I mean, the amounts at issue here varied so wildly that you really got the sense, you know, as an observer, and I went to two of her trials, that the juries were really picking numbers out of thin air, and there was really no way that they could do anything else. I mean, they were given no context during the trial about other copyright cases, how these things had been decided. The woman was tried under a law that was meant for an age when the only people who could reproduce music, you know, and steal it were, you know, major corporate operations. And so these damages were sort of absurd when applied to an individual. And yet all the jurors had was this range. You know, you could go between $750 and $150,000. How do we pick?
Well, it's an interesting book. The name of the book is The Internet Police. Nate Anderson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nate Anderson is the deputy editor at the online magazine Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. It's published by Norton. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.